Welcome to Truth vs. Hollywood. I'm David Chen.
And I'm Joanna Robinson.
Truth vs. Hollywood is a look at films that are based on a true story. But we don't just talk about the film, we also talk about that true story. On this podcast, we'll touch on what really happened, how that differs from the film, and why. And we're not just talking heads, we'll hear about the true story through interviews from experts, witnesses, and people who were involved in it. It's both the real facts and the real facts. R-E-E-L facts. What do you think of that, Joanna?
I loved it. Today we're talking about Martin Scorsese's classic film, Goodfellas. Goodfellas is based on the book Wise Guy by Nicholas Pileggi, which in turn is based on the life of mobster Henry Hill. Hill was actually alive when the film came out and was very pleased with this great film based on him. And as we'll talk about later, it definitely had an effect on his life. Pileggi worked with Scorsese to write the screenplay, and the film was a complete hit, nominated for 6 Academy Awards and won one, Joe Pesci, for supporting actor. It's considered one of the best gangster movies of all times. AFI put it on their list of 100 Years, 100 Movies, and the Library of Congress decided that it was culturally important and added it to its preservation archives.
All right, well, let's get to the movie itself. It stars Ray Liotta as Henry Hill, Robert De Niro as Jimmy the Gent Conway, who is based on Jimmy the Gent Burke, Joe Pesci as Tommy DeVito, based on Tommy DeSimone, Paul Sorvino as Paul Cicero, based on Paul Vario, and Lorraine Bracco as Henry's wife, Karen Hill. Many real-life figures that this movie was based off of, and apparently Henry Hill ended up getting paid $580,000 because of the use of his story in this movie, which is a lot of money to pay to a mobster who's done very horrible things. You know, in watching this movie again, Joanna Robinson, one of the things that I kind of realized, you know, or reflected on is the fact that we've, in the last few decades, seen so many movies about bad men doing bad things, and that this movie is kind of one of the prototypical examples of how they can be glorified and elevated. And this kind of movie makes that lifestyle look really glamorous, while at the same time depicting some of the negative consequences of that lifestyle. But at the same time, it does rub me the wrong way that, like, the people who are involved often are rewarded. We also saw this with Martin Scorsese's Wolf of Wall Street as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
A similar dynamic there. So I'm kind of curious, like, as you're reflecting on your overall experience of watching the movie, and now that we know a little bit more about what happened with the real life characters, and we're going to talk about it during the course of this podcast, like, how did it strike you that this is based off of a real person?
I think Scorsese couldn't have picked a better real life subject to glom onto here than Henry Hill, because though he is a gangster and he's fully involved in this gangster life, he is the likability of this character, which is really what Scorsese was going for. I've seen interviews where he talked about the 1932 Scarface, which was the first time he ever saw gangsters depicted as really likable. And you have Henry Hill, and he does terrible things, but he's a gangster who is a little squeamish. We see this throughout the film, and it's corroborated by, you know, true story of his life. He was violent. He did crimes, but he wasn't a mass murderer. And, you know, the charisma of him, I think, is really important.
Yeah, he wasn't one of the most vicious people in the story.
Yeah.
And so I think you're making a good point that, like, if you're going to choose an entryway into this world, Henry Hill is probably the ideal candidate in this case. So, well, the film opens with three men driving in a car having a seemingly normal evening. It's then revealed that there is a captive in the trunk, and then they shortly after execute him. We immediately get Henry's voiceover with the iconic line, "As far back as I can remember, I always wanted to be a gangster." It's one of the most memorable openings in all of cinema history. Joanna Robinson, after nearly three decades, how effective did you find this opening?
Well, it's funny, you know, I was 8 years old when Goodfellas came out, or maybe nine. So I did not see it in theaters, and I didn't see it until later in life. And but by then it had already seeped into the culture because it was so iconic. You know, there's like the Animaniacs, Goodfellas pigeon parody, and like all sorts of stuff. So I was aware of the beats of it, even though
your first exposure to Goodfellas was Animaniacs, is what you're saying, right?
1,000%. Absolutely. But, you know, so by the time I had seen it, I had also seen so many things that had imitated it. And this is true of like so many of our great films. Like by the time you get around to watching it, maybe you've seen a bunch of people knock it off. And so you're like, well, how groundbreaking is this really? And this movie is incredibly groundbreaking. And what's funny is this opening is so famous to the point of almost parody. Like, you get this moment where he goes, as far back as I can remember, I always wanted to be a gangster. And it reminds me of that, like, record scratch. Yeah, it's me. I bet you're wondering how I got here, you know, sort of thing that we right. talk about. You know, and we've seen it, you know, in a more serious fashion, we've seen this sort of thing replicated. I'm thinking of like the premiere of Breaking Bad. You meet this person in the middle of a crime and then you find out how they got there. You know, so knowing that, it's not as fresh and innovative as it might have been if I had seen it in the theaters in 1990, but it's still, you can sense the iconic status of it. What do you think of it, Dave?
It's kind of hard to put yourself into the position of the first time you saw the movie, because I saw this movie, you know, decades ago, and I do think back then it wasn't clear to me like what was actually going on in the car right from the opening shot. You know what I mean? Like, it starts like so seemingly normal, these dudes just hanging out, and then all of a sudden you realize like something horrifying is happening. And I like that contrast. Like, now, like, because the scene is so iconic and everyone knows what happens, it's tough to remember that, like, there was a time in history when, like, many people didn't know that that was about to happen. But I can kind of imagine if I could rewind my life, you know, several decades and rewatch this again, like, that would be super effective and quite a shock when they open up the trunk on Billy Bats. So, anyway. Love the opening. It still is great. And the freeze frame, you're right. Many things have parodied it. Many things have been derived from it. But it is still a legendary moment in this movie and in all of the cinema. And I quite loved it. So. After this scene, we cut to Henry Hill's life as a child. It's a very modest upbringing. And one of the things I like about this movie is, you know, we often see mob movies and the mob characters are already fully formed, right? But Goodfellas invites you into the world of a child who is viewing the mob from the outside and why they might find the mafia to be so intoxicating. What did you think of these early scenes with Henry Hill in childhood?
I love this opening. You know, we cut to the eyeball, right? Directly on his eyeball. And then we see what he's seeing out the window. And I didn't take many film studies classes, but I did take one where we learned about Martin Scorsese's upbringing. And I know that he had really serious asthma. And that meant that he was, you know, like, he couldn't go out and play. It's why he went to go see movies a lot. He couldn't, like, go play in the streets with friends. And he was also stuck at home a lot. And he's written and talked a lot about how he was sort of like a shut-in as a kid and used to watch the cinema of the streets, like, from his window. And so he's put himself, like, his own childhood, basically, in this Henry Hill opening. And I think that's fascinating and telling that he, like, he wants us there with Henry. But then he, like, because he's also put himself there. You know what I mean? I just think that's a really interesting choice.
We should also say that the actor who plays young Henry Hill, Christopher Cerrone, bears an uncanny resemblance to Ray Liotta. I thought they did a great job casting young Henry Hill.
You know how, like, sometimes you don't understand what's unique about someone's face until you've seen them try to cast a younger version of them?
Yes.
And you're like, oh,
yes.
There's something with the eyes. It's really amazing, the kid they found there. Yeah, it's a great
job. Indeed, indeed. Well, Daniel Simone, who wrote the book Lufthansa Heist, which is about Henry Hill's most lucrative robbery, gives us some more insight into Henry's background and upbringing.
His father was an electrician who worked for wages. The family was rather large. Their apartment was cramped. It was not the type of situation where every sibling had his or her own room, for example. They shared beds. They shared everything. He happened to have been reared in a neighborhood infested with mafia gangsters. In fact, right across the street from his home was a taxicab stand owned and operated by Paul Vario and his brothers.
So Henry literally walks into the taxi stand and he starts working for Vario, or in the film, Cicero, who's played by Paul Sorvino. Early on, we meet Robert De Niro's character, Jimmy Conway. He's made out to be an extremely appealing and charismatic figure in the film. I mean, it is a young Robert De Niro, after all. He looks awesome. He looks, like, magnetic, luminous. And young Henry really takes a shine to him and aspires to be that exact type of gangster, living the high life, having connections. And Daniel Simone says the real-life Jimmy was the same way.
he was prosperous. He was respected by the family bosses, particularly Paul Vario. In fact, many of the mafia families at times would compete for his association because he was such a reliable earner through schemes and manipulations. And Henry Hill loved all those characteristics about Jimmy Burke. He loved the fact that Jimmy Burke would be respected wherever he went, into a restaurant, into a nightclub. Chairs would pull out immediately. Jimmy Burke did not need reservations to book the best table in a restaurant. And these were all the fascinating, intoxicating traits that Jimmy Burke wielded and were all attractive to Henry Hill.
Something I really love about what this film does is it takes the American dream, the idea we have of wealth and success, and puts it in this world of the mafia. And I just like what that says about the American dream to begin with. It really exposes sort of some of the violence and the brutality that we sometimes like to gloss over when we think of the sort of the most picturesque version of the American dream. So what I like about this film, as opposed to, some other gangster films like The Godfather, you think of like Marlon Brando in a tux, The Height of Luxury. This is a film about blue collar criminals, blue collar mafia, selling cigarettes, like little penny ante sort of crimes to start with. So we get this montage of Jimmy stealing things with Henry. We're introduced to young Tommy DeVito. And then Henry gets caught selling stolen cigarettes. There's a short hearing scene and Henry is questioned. But he doesn't rat out anyone. And as the doors open from the courtroom, we see the entire mob family, which is now Henry's family, congratulating him and supporting him. The scene is a pivotal bit of foreshadowing and spells out the importance of the mafia code of omerta, which is silence. And we have Lorcan Otway, who owns the Museum of American Gangster, and Daniel Simone here to elaborate on that concept. First, you'll hear Lorcan, and then you'll hear Daniel.
The omerta code is not only applicable to people directly involved in organized crime in neighborhoods that were defined by organized crime and whose boundaries were created by organized crime. And it's the idea that if you informed, you died, as simple as that.
Omerta, code of silence, was instilled upon Henry Hill very, very early on when he became a protege of Paul Vario and subsequently a protege of Jimmy Burke. And of course, Paul Vario always told the story of when he beat senselessly his mistress because she had threatened to inform his wife of their dalliance, of their relationship. So the point was very, very emphatic that woman, child, or otherwise, if you do break that code of silence, the consequences can be quite severe.
We'll see much later on that omerta will become a key factor in Henry Hill's life. So then we flash forward to 1963, to an adult Henry and Tommy outside of JFK Airport. Henry's voiceover tells us that Polly had associates all over the airport, and so they stole from it basically when they wanted. This is important information for two future scenes in the movie. Then we get to the Bamboo Lounge, where we meet all of the crew. They all have tough-sounding or silly nicknames, but the important ones are the Burke crew, Jimmy, Tommy, and Henry. We get to see the dynamic between the three of them and also establish their personalities. Henry as laid-back and quiet, Jimmy as charming, and Tommy as a bit of a loose cannon. And of course, this leads us to the legendary scene where Joe Pesci asks, "What do you mean I'm funny?" And what do you think about this scene, Joanna? I mean, after all these years, I feel like it's still an extremely effective scene. Joe Pesci is the perfect mix of threatening, friendly, convivial, but also he just has this like underlying menace that you want to stay out of the way of. Your thoughts?
Yeah, we get a couple iconic things in the scene, right? So we get Pesci, who, as we already mentioned, won the Oscar for this performance. And then we get my favorite example of one of the scariest thing in all of cinema, which is Ray Liotta's laugh. you know what I mean? When he's laughing and you're like laughing and then it's just like, it's so maniacal and his eyes are gleaming, but he's having a good time. I just like fear the Ray Liotta laugh. I love it. And something that's really fun about the scene is that it was improvised, quasi-improvised, that that Pesci had this real life experience. He grew up around mobsters, and he was a young waiter, and he was on the wrong side of like calling a mobster funny, and he told Scorsese about it, and Scorsese put it in the film. But what Scorsese did in order to make sure that everyone would look put off and weirded out by what was going off, as they do, is he only told Pesci and Leota to do this, and everyone else in the scene did not know this was coming. And so, and you get a lot of wide shots, so you get just a lot of these reactions of people being like, what the hell? and it's really effective. And I think, you know, that's one of the reasons why it's so effective, is that Scorsese isn't known for, you know, a ton of improv in his films, but this is a wild card he threw in there, and it really pays off.
Yeah, I mean, what's great about it is, you know, as with many moments in the movie, you get this quick turn from, hey, everyone's having a great time, to someone might die here tonight. You know, like, that it happens so fast, like within seconds. And, you know, in this scene, Joe Pesci beats up the restaurant owner a little bit, and, you know, that's a little troubling. But it really does hint at some of the more darker elements of the story that will come to light much later, that, like, these people really do live lives that are, that at any moment, if you say the wrong thing, your life could be under threat. So I do appreciate both that dynamic, and also Pesci's performance is obviously legendary here.
Right. And he said that, you know, he's playing the character with about 90% accuracy, and that the only difference was that the real life Tommy was much taller and built like a bodyguard. And Pesci's, the whole thing about Tommy that works so well is like Pesci's, he's hyper defensive about his masculinity. And I think that works with someone who looks like Pesci, who's sort of like slightly more diminutive than his cohorts, and why he would have such a chip on his shoulder about it.
Agreed. So shortly after this, we're introduced to the character of Karen, played by Lorraine Bracco, on a double date with Henry. I remember the first time watching this movie being very disoriented by the introduction of a second voiceover. I feel like it's extremely rare to get a film that has only two voiceovers, Joanna. I mean, usually it's like many voiceovers or only one. How did you feel this movie balanced the stories of Henry and Karen, Joanna?
It's obviously not quite a two-hander. You know what I mean? This is Henry's story.
Yeah.
But actually, I love that Karen's voice is in here. I think it's really important for us to get inside her head to understand why she stays with Henry. So I think we need that internal monologue. Well, a fun fact is that in the original book, the Wise Guy book, there are these interludes that are told from Henry's perspective and told from Karen's perspective. There are a few other voices in there, like a girlfriend or an FBI agent, you know, but we get Henry and Karen's actual voices in the book itself. So, and some of the lines that Scorsese used in the film here are lifted directly from that, like, sort of quasi voiceover aspect from the book. So I bet you didn't know we were getting a smug book reader moment in this podcast, but I always want to find a way to work it in. But I think it's important to have so much of Karen in this film. I think it adds to a few things. It adds to that, like, pull that Henry has that, you know, Jimmy and Tommy don't really seem to share, which is that home life pull. We see Jimmy's family, we see Tommy's, like, mom, but we don't see that sort of, like, actual stress of the double life the way that we eventually see it so much with Henry. And I think Karen is a key aspect of that. And she's also really relatable, not like really relatable, but much more relatable than a bunch of mobsters. And so to be inside her head and to witness her seduction alongside Henry's seduction into this world just pulls us deeper into the narrative, I think.
Agreed, Joanna. And I think at first Karen seems like a sheltered suburban girl from Long Island, but then she tracks Henry down when he stands her up, and we see that she can be just as tough as he is, and she doesn't shy away from confrontation. How they met and moved to the suburbs, as depicted in Goodfellas, was actually accurate, and journalist Diana Blass talks about how maintaining that American dream-esque lifestyle was also part of being a mobster.
Henry meets Karen through a double date. And initially, he didn't really like her that much, but was attracted to her over time because she's a say-it-like-it-is New Yorker. She's actually Jewish, so she's very different than the typical Italian Catholic mobster. And I think that's what Henry was attracted to, that she was different. But she also was very innocent, and she didn't understand what she was really getting involved with at the end of the day. So having a wife and family when you're in the mob makes you seen as more respectable, and in line with their traditions. And you have your home with the white picket fence out in the suburbs like Long Island. But then on the side, you could still have your mistresses, your girlfriends, but you always go home to your wife and kids at the end of the day. And that's something that Henry Hill always aspired to, because that goes along with the persona of being in the mob.
Something I really like about the Karen and Henry story, which is true to life, but also helps thematically with the film, is that they're both kind of quasi-outsiders to this mobster life because of their... cultural heritage. Karen is Jewish and Henry is half Irish. And so neither of them are, you know, in all the way into this Italian mobster world. There are rules and you're an outsider if you're not full-blooded Italian, which we'll get into like some of the specifics of that later. But that's an interesting thing that binds them as outsiders. And we see them sort of looking from the outside in throughout the film, and I really like that. My favorite, obviously, like I think after the Pesci scene, after the I always want to be a gangster, the next iconic moment from Goodfellas is the Copacabana date, where it's this 3-minute tracking shot following Karen and Henry into the bowels of the Copacabana Club. Tons have been written about this, about how this is like a journey to the underworld. We get a lot of red motifs. They're going down into the bowels of the restaurant. The camera sort of stays at their eye level, so we see it all from their perspective, primarily sort of from Karen's perspective, because she's like, what is even all this world? And it really is. It's another way in which the filmmaking, there's a lot of like little filmmaking flares. Like Scorsese never wants you to forget about the camera in this movie, right? And there's a lot of filmmaking flares, and this is a really a moment where the filmmaking technique is really used to try to pull you inside of these two people. So I really love this scene. What do you think of it, Dave?
Yeah, I mean, it is certainly iconic. It's something that many filmmakers have imitated or been inspired by later on. I remember watching an interview with Martin Scorsese many years ago where he conveyed that the feeling he wanted you to get while watching this shot is the idea of like this entire world opening up to you, right? That like on the outside, you see all these people waiting in line like schmucks. And then, you know, Henry Hill just charges straight past them. He walks in. This whole world is available to him and right. by extension to Karen as well because of his connections, because of his status, and because he works in construction, as he later explains. But yeah, it's really effective. And it's one of those great moments when like filmmaking and theme is joined really closely. So awesome shot and one for the books. Shortly after this, we get to the first heist in the film, and it is of Air France. It happens extremely quickly, but we know it's lucrative and that it apparently went down pretty easily. Including this heist in the movie gives us an idea of what kind of things Henry is doing to make money and maybe sets up the bigger heist for later, but we don't really hear anything about how the heist was done, only that it has to do with copying a key. Daniel Simone tells us what did happen and how they pulled it off.
The security officer in charge of the cargo building had the only key to this high-value vault. It really wasn't a vault. It was really a secured room with a more sophisticated locking system, but nothing that couldn't be broken into. But, of course, Frenchie, the cargo supervisor, did not want the burglary to appear as a break-in. They targeted the security guard, the chief security guard who had the only key to the high-value vault. What they did, they broke into his apartment, believing or hoping that they would find the key to the vault. The only thing they found were porno magazines and all sorts of other sex-related paraphernalia. They decided to lure him to a nearby hotel. They hired a prostitute. After the guard and the prostitute left the room, Henry Hill went back into the room and removed the key to the vault from the key ring attached to the guard's pants. He and De Simone drove to a hardware store. They duplicated the key and replaced the original key back on the key ring. And the guard never knew that the key was ever missing or that it was duplicated.
So oftentimes when you're watching one of these epic Martin Scorsese films that are like 3+ hours long, say, or in this case, it's about 2.5 hours, you're like, surely there's nothing he left out, right? You know, like, obviously he put everything in. But what I think is fascinating is we don't get any of the heists in this film. There's this heist and later the Lufthansa heist. And partially I think it's because Henry wasn't involved with Lufthansa, and we'll get to that. But like, partly I think it's because we want to maintain him as not, you know, someone we want to be sympathetic with, right? So we don't show him doing too many bad, awful things. Plenty, but not too, like, maybe there's a line we don't cross. But I gotta say, I love a heist film, and I love a heist generally. And I kind of wish the heists were in this movie. What do you think, Dave? Do you wish the heists were in this movie?
I also love heists. But I mean, if you consider, I barely consider these to even be heist depictions in this film. You know what I mean? Like, heist movies generally follow a pretty specific template. There's a ton of exposition about why they need to do the heist, about what is involved with the heist. Then the heist goes down and almost always something goes wrong. None of that stuff happens in this film, right? And so I agree.
Know. Like, sometimes he gets he does some of it. He'll be like, and then there was Jimmy Lip, and I feel like he rattles off names of some of the gangsters who were there. And I'm like, when you do that.
Yeah.
Before the Lufthansa heist, and we'll get to that, he's like, his job was this, and his job was this. And I was like, why am I hearing about this and not seeing it? You know what I mean?
It is the barest lip service to heists, in my opinion. Yes. I think, what this movie is best at is just being, a nonstop, high-energy chronicle of this guy's journey through the mobster world. And so I think that, pausing to do, a heist and getting you emotionally invested just wouldn't fit with the rest of the film. That being said, I share your love for heists. I am disappointed we don't get to see heists. But those who are really appreciative of heists and Robert De Niro doing heists obviously have one of the best heist movies of all time, Heat, if they want to check that one out. There's other movies that feature many of these characters in heists, is what I'm saying. Anyway, the heist was nonviolent, but we'll soon see that Henry is not opposed to using violence when necessary. We get a couple scenes of Henry beating up some people. We're introduced to Maury through a very odd scene in which we see a commercial for his wig business, his hairpiece business. But he's not a gangster. He just has business dealings with the rest of the gang, and he owes Jimmy money. Jimmy strangles him until he agrees to relent. And then Karen is attacked by a guy in her neighborhood, and Henry tracks him down and pistol whips him. This is the first time that Karen sees the kind of violence Henry is capable of, and she kind of likes it. I just recently also saw a movie called Drive, the Nicholas Winding Refn movie. There's a scene in that movie where Ryan Gosling beats a guy to death in front of the woman that he loves, and she's kind of okay with it, potentially into it. Joanna, if somebody beat someone badly, you know, in trying to defend your honor, what would your reaction be? That might be too personal, but let's see what your response. I can do a different take on that, but let's go with that for now.
My reaction would not be to then hide the bloody pistol in a box somewhere. I think I'd be out of there. I mean, but this is once again a good reason to have the Karen voiceover, because we were I guess Lorraine Bracco, who's a great actress, could have just reacted to it, but I kind of like hearing her being I was kind of turned on by it, to be honest with you. What I think is kind of interesting is that we don't see Henry being violent a lot. When we do, it's usually connected to the women in his life, either directed at them or in defense of them. And that's just kind of an interesting choice. I don't know if this is a trigger of the real life Henry or if this is just a choice that Scorsese made. But I thought that was a fascinating connection. You'll notice when he gets violent, it's about that. And most of the time elsewise, he's trying to de-escalate violence. He's trying to get in between Jimmy or, Tommy and other people. Yeah. Maybe violence in defense of women feels sympathetic, but then he beats up his wife later and that's not so sympathetic. So yeah, there we go. All right, so speaking of that lovely marriage, Henry and Karen get married and they're living with his in-laws, and the in-laws are in an uproar that Henry is out every night. And when he gets home very early in the morning, they yell at him and he just drives off with another iconic Leota laugh, I should note.
Yeah, I mean, I really got the sense during this scene that This is a guy who the whole appeal of the gangster lifestyle is that he gets to do whatever he wants, right?
Yeah.
And so the idea of returning home to like a screaming mother-in-law, it just is like, he just has no time for any of that. He's like, you know what? Not even going to say anything. Just going to, you know, turn around and walk away.
Yeah.
And I thought it was a great illustration of their dynamic.
I love that. And I also love this next part where we see Karen at this hostess party, you know, basically a nail painting party for all the gangsters' wives. We meet Mickey, who's Jimmy's wife, and all the women are gossiping about mob business. And Karen does not feel at home at all. We get a lot of close up of Lorraine Bracco's eyes just like darting around. Like, what am I looking at? My favorite detail of the scene, you know, this is a beauty day for these women, but my favorite detail of the scene, is their terrible skin. And to me, there's no knock on terrible skin. If you have terrible skin, I am with you. But to me, what I think Scorsese is using it for is to show, I don't know, the stressors of this mafia lifestyle, or like the kind of rot underneath the facade. I find it a fascinating detail of this particular moment.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the other things to reflect on is, like, at what point do you feel Karen realizes what life she is signing up for? I feel like it happens pretty gradually during the course of the movie. There's no moment where she's like, I finally knew what kind of man I was with. You know what I mean? Like, it just kind of happens gradually. And that's one of the things I like about the movie is, like, there's no crucial moment, right? It just is a gradual set of things that you accept, things that you witness, that then end up engulfing you. And I think this scene is kind of one piece of that puzzle. Diana Blass suggests that it wasn't until Karen was only interacting with mobster wives that she even thought about it.
Karen was in a state of shock. She came from a very traditional background, and she was very ignorant in a way, not really understanding what she was surrounded by until she almost became suffocated by it, having to become friends with only the mobsters and their families.
Yeah, the movie shows Karen leaning into the idea of being a mob wife here. When served the warrant, she just, like, in a blasé way, makes coffee for the cops. She has expensive clothing. And in her voiceover, she rationalizes being proud of Henry for working so hard to provide for the family.
One of the things Henry Hill does to kind of get into a legit business to provide for the family is he acquires the Suite Lounge. And we're shown the outside of the Suite Lounge, and we'll see them meet here quite often during the course of the film. In real life, the Suite was a club that Henry bought as an attempt to have a legitimate establishment, and Lorcan Otway, who's the owner of the Museum of the American Gangster, explains how that came about.
Even with the financial success, Karen really wanted a stable life for her kids, and she convinces Henry, and I think Henry really felt that it was the right thing to do to try and establish a legitimate business, go straight, and certainly having succeeded for Polly, and Polly had known him since he was a young child and felt that he should have a chance to make something of his life. And Polly actually, when Henry builds the restaurant and goes straight, Polly makes it off limits to mobsters. Henry was a natural restaurateur. A number of things made him a great restaurant owner. And he had a natural flair for cooking and hospitalities.
But of course, we see Henry's friends started to hang out at the Suite. And once Jimmy and Tommy started hanging out,
he truly believes in friendship. And his crew begin to habitually hang out at the restaurant. I think that what made it inevitable that the Suite would become a hangout for his immediate crew was Henry's sense of loyalty and joviality, and the fact that he wanted his friends to enjoy what he was enjoying. Henry couldn't see himself partying without his friends. And I think that he wasn't so much at first interested in remaining within organized crime so much as taking care of his friends and extending hospitality to those who helped him get where he was.
So much for the legitimate business. The film has the place already designated as a mob hangout as we cut to the Conway crew going for drinks with Billy Batts, played by Frank Vincent. Billy is just out of prison and used to know Tommy from when he was a kid. He keeps bringing up that Tommy was a shoeshine boy, and Tommy, as we've seen earlier, does not like to lose face in front of others. This is absolutely not going to end well. Tommy takes it on the shoulder for about a minute before losing his temper. Cut to the end of the night. Billy is drunk at the bar, and then Jimmy and Tommy kill Billy. Henry, who is not involved, nonetheless helps his friend hide the body, and they get him into the trunk of the car. This is actually, again, kind of a flash forward from the beginning of the film, right? Why is this so important that it's the first thing of the movie? It's actually the turning point for this crew. We know as an audience from this point on, this is going to be hanging over all their heads. They kill people all the time, but Billy was a made man, which means he couldn't be killed without permission. Now, the film makes it seem like it was an impulsive fight between Tommy and Billy. Like, Tommy had been egged on and he just had a temper. But author Daniel Simone explains there is much more to the killing than just that.
Because when Billy Batts went to prison, Jimmy Burke kind of snuck in there and took over Billy Batts' operation. So now Billy Batts wanted his territory back. And Jimmy Burke simply was not going to allow that. And that was the reason, the real reason why they killed him. So it was a joint effort between Jimmy Burke with the assistance of Tommy DeSimone.
I love the use of Donovan's song Atlantis here. It's just a really eerie juxtaposition between this very like surreal hippie sort of song played over this extreme violence, one of many incredible musical moments in the film. But what Daniel just said helps underline for me, it really helps illuminate the scene, because I just never really understood why Jimmy helped Tommy kill the Billy Batts. It's a move that looks completely insane. Why would you kill one of the few people that would make you a target by mob law? Daniel also explains why Henry was not in the same danger that the rest of the crew was.
When Tommy DeSimone and Jimmy Burke killed Billy Batts inside the suite, Henry's nightclub, in a court of law, Henry Hill would have been implicated as an accomplice, at very, very least. But in mafia circles, that doesn't really apply. Whoever did the actual killing, whoever ordered the killing, whoever set up Billy Batts for the killing, that was the person who would be responsible. Billy Batts happened to have been one of John Gotti's crew. And Billy Batts, until he went to prison, had been a good earner for John Gotti. And that was the reason why John Gotti was very upset when Billy Batts disappeared.
In fact, we never see Henry kill anyone. He engages in violence and has many guns, as we've talked about, but at no point does he murder anyone. He's a sympathetic gangster for this reason, but it's also a reason he's on the outside. This is why Jimmy leaves him out of the Lufthansa heist later.
I think the Billy Batts murder is probably the one that hits the hardest for me out of all the killings and deaths in the whole movie. I mean, aside from them just showing it multiple times in the course of the film, it's the juxtapositions that are so effective, right? The initial beating is brutal. You brought up the use of Donovan. Jimmy Conway is pissed about getting his shoes dented during the course of the killing, right? And it just is interesting that they bring up such trivial concerns during the perpetrating of such a horrifying crime. And then Tommy feels bad about getting blood on the floor, not about the actual murdering he's doing that might get them all killed. Then they go to visit Tommy's mom. You get a glimpse of their humanity before they take Billy out to the middle of nowhere to bury him. Billy is in the trunk, presumably alive during the entire time that they're having this conversation. And, you know, Tommy's kissing his mom. And it's just people are complicated and contain multitudes, John Robinson. I don't know if you knew this.
I did know this. And also, fun fact, that's Martin Scorsese's real mom playing Tommy's mom in that scene. And one of my favorite shots actually is when they first come into the kitchen and they're greeting her. I mean, this very bizarre interlude. They're greeting her. And there's a moment where Ray Liotta looks completely out of character to me. He's just sort of like smiling very fondly at this woman. And I feel like he's just like, oh, Marty Scorsese's mom. She's so cute. But she's great in this movie. I love her in this movie. And like, yeah, they're at the dinner table. They're talking about her painting. They're talking about how the painting looks like the guy that they've got bleeding in their trunk or whatever. And then you like pan outside and you hear the sort of muffled thumps from the trunk. So yeah, this guy is gruesomely bleeding out in the Trump while they're having, you know, marinara or whatever. So,
yeah, apparently the painting from the movie is based on a photo from National Geographic. So it's like a painting of a photo. And yeah, it's just such a weird, generic detail thrown in there that when you think about it is kind of shocking that they would go into it in this moment. But it's one of the many odd touches that makes Martin Scorsese such an amazing and original filmmaker, and I think like cements this movie as one for the ages. So that's the end of part one of our Goodfellas episode of Truth vs. Hollywood. What do we have to look forward to in part two? Things are only downhill from here. Henry's marriage is going downhill, there's going to be trouble with the law, and that Billy Bat's murder is not going away. We'll also get to hear from the FBI agent involved with the case how the real Henry Hill was affected by the movie. Truth vs. Hollywood is an Audio Boom and World Media Rights co-production hosted by me, David Chen.
And me, Joanna Robinson.
It is produced by Audio Boom's Rachel Jacobs, Casey Georgie, Blair Payton, and Lauren Vogel, and by Pascal Hughes for World Media Rights, with help from James Tyndale. And if you want to find more of Joanna Robinson and my work, you can find me over at Culturally Relevant at culturallyrelevantshow.com. It's a podcast where I interview filmmakers and artists every week. And also the Slash Filmcast at slashfilmcast.com, where I talk about movies on a weekly basis. How about you, Joanna?
I am, believe it or not, rewatching the television show Lost one episode at a time, so you can hear us cover that and get great interviews from people who worked on the show at thestormpodcast.com. It's called The Storm. Or you can hear me talking about award season movies. This qualifies as one, Goodfellas, over on the Little Gold Men podcast for Vanity Fair.
Until next time, stay truthful, people.